The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the second of a three-part series of Science Weekly extras investigating the scientific, technological and sociological challenges around food, energy and water sustainability. Hosted by Joe Confino, executive editor of The Guardian and director of Guardian Sustainability, an expert panel discussed the entwined relationships, the nexus, between the world's water supplies, food production and the energy needed to produce the water and food to feed a growing planet. This debate, looking at the role of water and food in energy production, was originally live-streamed on guardian.co.uk in February 2013, and it is brought to you in association with the brewer S.A.B. Miller.
Hello and welcome back to the second Guardian Nexus debate, which is in association with S.A.B. Miller. The first session was about water for food, and this session we're going to concentrate on the roles of food and water in producing energy. Going to look at everything from biofuels to fracking, because actually what we recognise is that these are becoming increasingly important issues in the energy sector. I wrote down one fact, which I thought was quite interesting, gives you a sense of how important the subject is, that in the US, nearly half of all water withdrawals in the US are used for cooling thermoelectric power plants. So while we like to think of sort of these things in isolation, actually water and food are becoming increasingly important in energy. We've got a fantastic lineup of panelists to discuss that. So we've got Herbert Oberhansley, who's chief economist of Nestle. We've got Camilla Toulmin, director of the London-based IIED, which stands for the International Institute for Environment and Development. And lastly, David Norman, who's Director of External Affairs at WWF. So welcome to all of you. What we asked each of the panellists was to do is to pick one subject within this Nexus debate to actually focus on, something they think is particularly important. So we're going to start with you, Herbert. So if you can just take the word out of your envelope, show us what it is, and then we can biofuels. Great. So Herbert, why did you pick on biofuels?
Actually, the idea of producing fuel on the field, let it grow with the sunlight, is not a bad idea. It becomes a problem in the context of food and water in the nexus. And probably it was said this morning that we are already overusing water, and this overuse is rapidly increasing. One scenario says that by 2030 we should expect food production, basic cereal production shortfall in the order of 30%. And this biofuel story adds massively to it. Now we don't have to wait for 2030 to find out what this might mean. 2008 was a big surge in the production of biofuels, some 35% additional production. You had then also announcement of subsidies, meanwhile mandates. You have meanwhile 30 countries across the world with mandates for biofuels. Subsidies, 2010, 22 billion for a total amount, production amount of 60 billion. It's huge. It will accumulate to $1.2 trillion. Trillion is where I always have to start counting the zeros behind. So it's huge amounts. And it's not surprising that this kind of signals, 2008 and the years before, had an impact on prices and food prices. Basic staple food cereal went up 200%. Now, this is not a problem for us here when we go to a fancy restaurant eating some nice Italian pasta. Might be a bit more expensive, but doesn't matter. It does matter for Nestle, but it's something we can manage at Nestle, especially since we are increasingly going into higher value-added food. But it does matter to a very large extent for those people who are living 60% more spending on food and 2/3 of it on basic foodstuff, on basic cereals. So this is the concern.
Okay. Now, Herbert, if, let's say, there'd been a really deep understanding of the nexus a good few years ago and what had been brought into the biofuels debate, would we have got a different answer?
Probably not, because even now it's difficult to discuss, because we have three powerful lobbies behind this move to biofuels. It's an additional income for farmers, so you have the farmers' lobby. You have those people who think you can get some energy independence, which I think when you look at the orders of magnitude, doesn't work. And then it's still this hope that you can do something for the climate. Now, this mixture of three groups who are really following also legitimate concerns overrides apparently the concern for water as the specific issue, and these people living on staple food.
Okay, David, just coming to you, I mean, is this, are biofuels part of the answer, or actually have we just got it completely wrong?
So I think they can be part of the answer. The essence here is it depends. All of those things are absolutely right. But my colleagues in WWF Brazil looked carefully at, using kind of nexus sort of analysis, looked carefully at the different kind of biofuels that are possible there. So they compared biofuels from sugarcane with, for example, biodiesel from soya. So now the soya one is an absolute disaster. It involves clearing tropical forest. It's not, you know, far from carbon neutral. It's a monstrous. It just doesn't achieve anything. Now, when they looked at that compared with the sugarcane, there's certainly, if done properly, it doesn't seem to set up incentives for competition with other forms of food. It doesn't seem to lead to land clearance, and it's very, very efficient in terms of the conversion. So I think it's quite important to hold on to this, it depends, and to recognise that we shouldn't so easily just campaign against all biofuels, because from WWF's perspective, the idea, it's a form of solar energy effectively, the idea in principle is good. The key thing is to set the kind of standards, and the roundtable on responsible biofuels is a good set of standards that ensures it does lead to genuine carbon reductions and does benefit people and does, of course, not lead to tropical forest clearances.
Okay, Camilla, what's your view?
I think that, as David rightly says, it depends very much on whether or not you're looking at sugarcane or a whole range of other crops, particularly where growing those crops would clear people off the land. Some of the land grabs that we see going on are very much driven by this demand for feedstock into biofuels, mm-hmm. Or whether it involves clearing jungle, tropical forest, which we can really ill afford to clear at this stage. I'd like also just to introduce the idea of biomass as a form of energy, which actually is 3/4 of renewable energy globally. Of course, particularly important for many poor people in developing countries, and essentially a carbon neutral source of energy, as long as you get sufficient replanting of that biomass to keep the whole system going.
Okay. Well, one of the things I wanted to bring up is what Herbert said about subsidies and about vested interests, because actually you can have all the knowledge of how we need to think systemically, but actually if you have perverse subsidies and you have powerful interest groups behind it, how do we start to break that deadlock, you know, that hold over us?
Well, I think it's also that we've got a very strong inertia in our transport systems. I mean, essentially we've got massive infrastructure of roads, of cars, of lorries, and of petrol filling stations. So the easiest thing to do is to try and see how you can bring into that existing network a new source of fuel. An alternative, of course, would be to try and get far more in the way of electric-powered mm-hmm. vehicles.
Okay. And Herbert, just from your perspective, I mean, you talk about powerful interest lobbies. Well, you're one of the biggest multinationals in the world. You have relationships with lots of other sort of large companies. I mean, how come you can't change the tide?
It's always powerful companies. You have to see it in perspective. Food market is a huge market. We have actually 1.5% market share. This is a highly fragmented market. And I think we can take leadership, especially if the chairman is taking this up. But we cannot impose anything. We have to be realistic. But let me come back to one point. I think one point that is very important is orders of magnitude. You have, on the two sides, you have calories. Calories for food, you have calories for energy. But when you measure in calories, the energy market is 20 times as big as the food market. Mm. So very small percentages of food transferred into, very small percentages of the energy market be covered by foodstuff has already a devastating impact. But I agree with you, among all these biofuels, I think the sugarcane story is the one where really, where there are quite a number of positive elements. Also, using waste, something that we are involved, for instance, helping farmers to transform manure into biogas on the one side and dry fertilizer, it also protects the water. So it's not as general. You start with a strong general statement, but then we differentiate as well.
Okay, well, we may come back to biofuels, especially about second-generation biofuels. But Camilla, let's look at the issue you brought to bear.
Let's have a look in the envelope. Yeah. Right.
Dams. So Camilla, why dams?
I chose dams because dams are potentially a hugely important source of low-carbon power energy. They're also a very important means by which you can develop irrigated agriculture. So for a continent like Africa, only 4% of its land is irrigated. There's clearly huge potential to increase that area, the proportion of area irrigated, with lots of opportunities to increase yield as a consequence. But dams have often excited opposition, particularly big dams, because of the implications that they have for areas downstream of the dam, where you get a change in the flow of the water going down, often with really quite damaging impacts on the biodiversity, the plant life, the bird life of the region. And also because big dams have tended to be imposed by governments forcing resettlement and big changes in the livelihoods and assets of people affected by that big infrastructure. Yeah. So trying to make sure that we can get the benefits of dams while reducing to a minimum many of the costs is one of the areas in which we've been working at IID in particular.
Great. Just want to bring that back to, in terms of WWF, I mean, there's so many options, aren't there? We talk about there are biofuels, there's dams, there's all sorts of potential answers. But how do we decide between them? How do we actually know where we should be putting? Is the answer multitudes and we just do everything? Or is it that we need to focus? How do we prioritise answers?
Well, I think the heart of this is decent analysis that leads to cross-sectoral policy solutions here. So the dams example is a really good one here, as Camilla has said. In principle, this is a good thing. In principle, this can be a carbon neutral source of power. But when that energy demand trumps all the other considerations in the Nexus debates, you get into deep trouble. If you look, for example, at the lower Mekong, so countries like Laos and Cambodia and Vietnam, huge interest in developing hydropower on the lower Mekong. Of the 11 really big dams proposed on the mainstream of the river Mekong, five of them are proposed to be more than 50 metres high. Mm-hmm. And that's absolutely preposterous because the 60 million people that live there, almost all of them depend on the river for their livelihoods. The fish that are the protein in the river are, you know, the top, and in some cases the only source of protein for many of them. And those fish are not going to be able to migrate up dams that are 50 metres high. Now, a thoughtful analysis, exactly as Camilla said, says there are possibilities for developing the power in ways that are also balanced with the biodiversity and with the food security and with the water needs of those people. And they're often smaller but more installations, perhaps off the main run of the river. So that sort of deeper analysis that's looking not just at energy in isolation but at all those wider needs comes up with some answers.
Okay. Now, but I want to bring you in here because often policy is made at the top level and everyone's looking for the big answer. But here's an example where actually dams may have an answer, but actually it's not necessarily the scale in terms of the size of the individual projects, the scale and the multitude of the smaller projects. So how do we get sort of governments and other key players to actually recognise actually that the answer is not always the big project, but a multitude of smaller projects?
You cannot imagine Swiss prosperity without dams. Switzerland has no raw materials, it had no energy before. It was in the 1850s, 1860s, it was one, if not the poorest country in Europe. So without this source of energy, without also the impact on stabilizing the flow of rivers, it would have been impossible to be where we are today. So there is, in principle, a positive preposition towards dams. But then I think, and there, Swiss system has a certain advantage of having the discussion about different concerns. You cannot have a completely free lunch. You will always see then rivers that have only what is a minimum of the water remaining before the water returns to the main bed. So, but you have to discuss that, and as you said, you have to balance interests that include the ballots, the interest of the population there, the interest of the nature that is concerned. Nature there is also an economic dimension because it's about tourism. Mm-hmm. So you need a discussion, and I think it works quite well. But in the end, going back, without these dams, Switzerland would not be where it is today.
Camilla, I just want to bring in, I mean, obviously, dams all very well, but you need water, and what we're getting in certain regions is such a shortage of water that you're seeing, let's say in China, power stations going down in capacities, or in 2003, French nuclear power stations being shut down because of lack of water. I mean, you know, we look at these things as answers in terms of the resource available now, but if water scarcity hits as hard as we think, then actually, is that still going to be an answer?
Well, indeed. And if you take a region like West Africa, where it's very unclear what the climate change predictions tell us, but it could well be alongside greater temperatures, there'll be significantly less rainfall. And then you've got the big River Niger, which is the backbone for so many countries in the region. There are now more than 20 dam schemes being proposed for the River Niger, which if you did them all and rainfall became less reliable, you'd see an awful lot of failed schemes and terrible difficulty for people in the region.
And so, David, just coming back in terms of sort of international negotiations, every country is, you know, in times of scarcity becomes often more protective. So Camilla gives the example that, you know, across Africa, if it, one scheme can be fine, but actually if everyone does it, then it becomes a problem. But how do we start to deal with these complexities on an international stage where actually having an impact in one, doing something in one country has a terrible impact sort of going down the chain?
Well, environmental issues at the heart of that. So many of them cut across borders. I suppose the answer is that at a local level and at a cross-national level, we have to recognise there are not straightforward, simple solutions. And if one powerful interest group, and in particular interest groups behind rapid growth in energy demand, which is of course necessary for development and poverty eradication, but if that trumps everything else, and if that trumps in the interest of one country against its neighbours, you can lead to catastrophic long-term effects that more than outweigh the benefit of the individual project.
Okay, so that brings us, I think, a good segue into your issue you brought. So let's...
I have got biodiversity.
Okay. And why that in particular?
So, perhaps a controversial one. I think people often feel that it, when you have the prospect of population growing to 10 billion around the planet, when you have, you know, an extraordinary and very welcome growth in people's livelihoods, people's quality of life, a rapid rate of people being lifted out of poverty, those are the sorts of issues that should be right front and centre of policymakers' concerns. And frankly, biodiversity, or leaving the jargon behind, nature and natural systems, kind of gets left to the back seat. I would argue that we can't afford to do that. And the reason for that is because so much of what people need, what we care about, what we value, whether our food, our clean water, our clean air, our jobs and livelihoods, our health, ultimately our entire economic systems, they're all rooted in natural systems. And it's very easy to think, for example, about rapid growth in energy production at all costs. And the danger of that is it cuts across other considerations like biodiversity. And so you get an immediate win in terms of economic growth and energy growth, but at the cost of destroying your natural systems that underpin your entire economy. If just take one simple example, going back to the Lower Mekong, a very biodiverse, rich river. So there's about 850 freshwater species in the river Mekong. At least a third of those need to migrate long distances, sometimes more than 1,000 kilometres, in order to reproduce. As soon as you understand that, that brings you again to the heart of nexus thinking. You can't have 50-metre-high dams in the way of those migrations because those people that depend on those fish are not going to be able to eat.
But isn't one of the problems that, actually, when you look at the issues, what comes first is, energy and food and water, which actually is at the heart, actually, of the debate, fulcrum of the debate, gets left out because nature actually doesn't have that voice. Doesn't have the value. And actually, everyone's looking after the short-term needs of growing society. So how do you manage that?
So I think it's, again, a deeper understanding of the connections and recognising that often local communities understand those connections sometimes better than ministries that are often divided terribly sectorally, that exclude other considerations in focusing on a single rapid drive towards a particular policy. So the government of Laos, for example, wants that country to be the battery of Southeast Asia, again, coming back to the dams issue. If that trumps all other considerations, then you have the people left out of the debates.
Herbert, I mean, can we afford to protect everything about the environment? I mean, at what point do we start to make choices about what's protected and what's not, and how do we make those choices?
Maybe it's slightly overlapping. It's about environmental flows. And when you defend from any perspective, from a societal perspective, also from a business perspective, environmental flows, biodiversity is a part of it. But then it's also in some areas where you overpump water, where water tables are falling, especially in the land below the Himalayas, you have relatively high content of arsenic in the rocks. The further down the water table, the higher the content of arsenic. So if you don't protect the environmental flows, you are also damaging not only the environment with the biodiversity, but also the people. Overpumping in places like Jakarta, also New Orleans, leads to subsidence. Some parts of Jakarta are sinking down in the order of 40, 50 centimeters per year. This is just next to the sea. So it is, I think, this understanding has to go, has to, of course, include and have a priority biodiversity, but you have to understand this environmental flow again also to protect humans.
And Camilla, I mean, on that, I mean, there's one of the things that came out very much in Rio as a new force of change was the idea of valuing natural capital.
Exactly.
I mean, some people say actually the commons should never be valued because actually they should be left alone and not brought into the economic system. And others say, actually, it's only by giving them an economic value that you seek to protect them. What's your view on that?
Well, I go along with the second line. I think that one of the problems about environment is that it includes a lot of things that aren't owned, that we have a lot of free riders who use those resources and don't bear the costs of that use. So I think there's a lot to be said for trying to value the importance of many of the environmental assets on which ultimately our life depends, whether it's atmosphere, whether it's water, or whether it's the deep interconnections in nature that allow for a flourishing, productive ecosystem.
How about, I just want to come back to the whole issue of the nexus, because
yes,
the reason people probably like specialisms is because they can really deeply understand it and they can sort of say, actually, I have the answers to this. As soon as you stand back and you look at the nexus, it can be really overwhelming. Say, well, if I do that, everything has an impact on everything else. And that can actually sometimes stop everyone from doing anything because you say, God, what do I do if everything has an impact on everything else? How do I make changes? So, I mean, is nexus thinking, has it got the possibility of actually preventing action from happening, or actually is it a driver of change?
It is a driver of change, definitely, but you need additional tools. And I think valuing certain elements, be it valuing commons, also understanding what is cost-effective, what is relevant within the complex of an issue, I think is highly important. So if you put water in the center, water overuse as the major threat, then you try to understand how effective you are within the nexus with certain levers when you start to move. Right now, we are still too often working in piecemeal, also as companies, trying to do something that looks good. But we have to understand the nexus, and I think with some economic instruments, and there are tools like this proposed in various studies, and increasingly, I think, also entering politics, you can really do something, and the nexus use the nexus as a driver.
Okay, David, just you first, I know you want to say something, but I want to also ask a question, which is that nexus thinking also involves nexus action, which is about collaboration. So,
yes.
So in the same way there's the ecosystem in the outside world, there's an ecosystem in terms of society. So you've got civil society, you've got corporates, you've got governments, you've got academics. What's the role in bringing those people together to drive change?
So I think collaboration is the answer to that question, fundamentally. The collaboration is the heart of the application of nexus thinking in many examples. If I could give one, the Water Futures program that WWF has a partnership with the big international brewing company, SABMiller. We've looked, for example, at the water footprint of the company's operations and local communities in countries such as Peru and Tanzania and South Africa. Now, the point of the analysis, that's going to be quite complex, links, bringing all these different threads together. But the purpose is then to share and develop that analysis with local stakeholders, local communities, and that comes up with action plans that are deeply thoughtful in terms of managing the trade-offs. Because fundamentally, this is often about trade-offs, and it's often about different groups' rights to access, for example, to water, and leaving water for nature so that the long-term natural resources on which those communities depend can be safeguarded. So again, those collaborations based on a deep and thoughtful analysis often come up with very thoughtful approaches to managing what is ultimately shared risk. So it's not individual or particular groups' interests, it's managing the shared risk of the communities and the companies as a whole.
Okay, Camilla, what's your view on how Nexus thinking is actually going to make things better rather than slow things down?
Well, as David rightly said, it allows you, particularly when you start putting prices on things, to see what the trade-offs are. It also allows you to move from dealing with people in the Ministry of Water or Environment to start demonstrating to ministers of finance, prime ministers and presidents that these questions are of prime importance for the nation's long-term well-being and security. So that rather than thinking about some small environmental problem, they can see the consequences of going down a particular route and the risks that that will bring in the long term.
Okay, thank you. I just want to turn to comments we've had on the website and Twitter questions. And Herbert, just want to come back to you because I just want to come back to the biofuels issue. So we got one from Roberta Rodriguez, researcher at the Complutense University of Madrid. It says, what is the future for the first generation biofuels? But also I want to bring in what is the future for the second generation, because a lot of people, you know, first generation ones, people say, oh, well, that didn't work. But the second generation ones are the answer. Well, how can you talk to us a bit about what is, how do you see that?
I hope there is no future for first generation, but that's a hope, because the reality is that this is really massively driven by subsidies, and I mentioned the amounts. And these amounts are for production. I wouldn't mind less if it was research subsidies. But if you subsidize this kind of production with this kind of percentages, with this kind of amount, it's unhealthy.
Okay,
there is a continuation.
Okay, but then people look for the next solution, the next salvation. Solution. The second generation biofuels, is that the case?
Second generation, and I mentioned briefly, there are niches, there are even some bigger opportunities where you can use waste and transform it into fuel. It's still not as easy as people think. It's technologically, it's more complex, and it is limited in the amounts. I know data from Germany where they estimated if you really bring together, and this is quite a logistic challenge, you bring together all the waste, transform it into energy, you may cover something like 2-3% of total energy consumption of Germany. So I think it's something that has to be done, but don't expect to solve the energy problem with it.
Okay, and David, just very briefly as an addendum to that, lots of people always look for the technological answer, when often there are lots of current answers. So what's the role of actually great new technology, or actually do we know enough now to actually solve it?
Well, there are so many solutions that we have now. You know, in the energy field, it's obviously energy efficiency. We still haven't begun to pluck the low-hanging fruit out of energy efficiency. But I think it's important that we do these things in parallel. So this example is an example of an early technology, and this is developing incredibly fast in the lab. The research is, you know, the energy needs for breaking down cellulose into its constituent sugars from waste materials. That's developing fast. The catalysts that can do that using lower energy are developing really rapidly. Now, the secret is, can that be scaled out? Can that be done at scale? But as you say, let's not let the excitement for that, which must be developed, trump the need for immediate action on the straightforward, you know, win-win-wins like energy efficiency.
Okay, Camilla, I just want to bring you in, because a lot of the conversation on Twitter this morning has been around short-termism versus long-termism, and especially on both politically and in terms of corporates, which is that actually we need to take a long-term horizon for this, but everyone is looking at short-term. So, and the answers can't be in the short-term. So, I mean, what's your view? Are we seeing a change in that dynamic? Are we, or actually in times of economic stress, actually everyone's actually hunkering down and going much more for the short-term? How do you see that?
I fear that's very much seems to be the pattern at the moment. I mean, we have a situation where citizens, society, groups of people see the urgency of the problems that we face and the need for long-term, loud, predictable policy directions. But at the same time, we've got governments, kind of government power held by people in political parties who face an electoral cycle and often, you know, even shorter term political challenges than that from people in their own party and elsewhere. So you've got a total mismatch between the governance and accountability system domestically in a particular country and the long-term needs of people, society, for a sustainable future. I don't know how we're going to square that.
Okay, and Herbert, from the corporate side of things, I mean, you are under pressure to keep on pushing your profits forward, forward, forward. It's very easy. You know, you're considered, companies considered leader in water, but there are many, many other companies that aren't doing anything about this at all. So, I mean, what's the responsibility of corporates to actually take a longer-term view, and how are we going to drive that change? Because everyone talks about the need for long-term thinking, very, very little of it's going on. I mean, you're an economist, you should be looking at it.
No, it's the key responsibility of a company, of a company leader, and of the people in a company to think long-term, to act long-term. And this is a responsibility for the company, for the shareholders on the one end, and it is a societal responsibility. So I fully agree. Now, then comes the pressure. You cannot talk about the long term and not be viable in the short term. But to bring these two together, that is a major responsibility. And I mean, you have different sectors. Maybe it's easier to say that and to live that in when you are in a food company. You are in certain sectors when you see what happens in IT, where leaders in one sector disappear from the scene from within 2 or 3 years. These people have to find ways to survive over these 2 or 3 years, or they are completely out. So it has to do with the acceleration of technology. It has then to do still with the financial markets. Mm-hmm. This is one of the pressure. And then there is also political pressure that brings certain short-term reactions. Quite often, you think you know what is necessary, what is best in the long term, but then you go for a kind of look-good solution because you have to please politics and the wider public.
Okay. I want to go to another question. We've got one from Barbara van den Ende, who's communications manager at the Dutch Agricultural Development and Trading Company. And she says, what role can grassroots organizations play in Africa in the improvement of the distribution of water, food, and energy resources? I mean, Camilla, this is because our tendency is to look at the big answers, but actually, you know, a lot of the answers are going to be at grassroots levels. How important is that, and how can those communities be supported in making those decisions?
Well, exactly. I mean, and thank you, Barbara. That's heartland work for an organisation like IID and our many partners around the world. I think that you have to find ways in which you can provide solutions for energy and for water management that makes sense to people in particular places. And those answers are going to be different depending on the context. So if you take a country like Mali, one where we've worked for many, many years, you've got huge amounts of solar energy hitting the country, which if you enable farmers to get access to solar panels, can transform the energy situation that you find in outlying villages far off from any kind of grid system. Equally, if you help people to collect water, rainwater as it falls, help it to channel into places where you can grow food, you can have a really transformatory effect on the vegetation and on the crop productivity in the region. But it depends on the soil, it depends on the landscape, it depends what farmers in that region know and want. So you need to work together.
And very, very quickly, what's the role of a company like Nestle, big, large multinational corporations, long supply chains reaching smallholder farmers? What's the role of a corporate in actually helping those communities at the local grassroots level find these changes?
Well, we've been doing a certain amount of work on this just in the last year, and we've got a new report out that looks at the importance of engaging in international supply chains. And what you find is it's really important for about 2 or 3% of the farming population who are well-educated, got great communications and access to markets. But for the vast bulk of the farming population, actually, it's the local market, it's the informal market that really matters. That's not to say that engagement in supply chains can't play a role, but I don't think we can expect Nestle and many other companies to offer the solution to rural development.
Okay. David, just want a question from Dr. Connie Zweig, who writes, with Monsanto owning seeds and multinationals owning water sources, how can individual farmers and consumers regain access and control of resources? I mean, is there a power issue? And I'll come to Herbert as well, because obviously Nestle has been accused of trying to take control of water sources. But I mean, what is there a power imbalance here?
I think there is a power issue, and it's best exemplified just looking, for example, at the length of a river and all the different interest groups that need to extract water along the length of that river. So for energy production, the intensification of water use for energy production has been rising everywhere, not just in the United States, and big agriculture and small farmers. So there's obviously a situation of competition for water, and many of the great rivers of the world no longer now even reach the sea. The water's all abstracted from those rivers before it reaches there. So it is a question of power. Multinational companies have an important role in terms of their license to operate in those places in not simply using the power that they have at their disposal through your financial muscle to just acquire what they need, but of course to work with the communities on which they depend to negotiate those rights between different groups that have very different power but all have potentially an equal right to the use of those water along the river.
Okay, and Herbert, obviously Nestle's come in for a lot, you're the largest, I think, water bottle in the world.
Yes.
Your company's come in for a lot of criticism about sort of taking control of local water sources at the expense of poor people. And at the same time, you've, as a company, have devised the whole idea of shared value, which is actually you can't be successful as a company unless the communities are also successful. How do you square your power up with the fact that actually you're this global player and there are these small communities who don't have power?
Complex story, just a few glimpses on it. First, this bottled water is a minute part of total water withdrawals. It's 0.009% of total water withdrawals for human use. What we sell is not water. We sell a service that water as hydration is available at the right time, at the right place, in the right form. We do some water that has a healthy component from spas, where originally you had to go there to drink. By the way, you still have free access in these places to the water. When you go to Vitel, for instance, which is one of our sources, you can go and drink your water from the fountain. We just are paid for bringing this water to another place. And all in all, the water as it goes into the company is a very small part. We are a very small water user. We are highly visible because afterwards people know the source. We also, one of the things that is important when you are responsible for a source, you're also responsible for the watershed. So we are paying for environmental services because we want to protect that water. Typically in this system of shared service, the whole town that is around has the advantage of much safer water because the agriculture around is managed in a way, and we pay for this kind of management, that the water source is protected. So it has to be put in context, very small, with the source responsibility, and then understand what the actual business is. It's not controlling the source, not selling the water, but the service of having water or hydration and a healthy hydration available at the right time, the right place, in the right form.
It's a profound insight that the commercial needs of the company depend on managing, for example, the watershed. This is a huge change from simply what duty does a company have to the community. Of course, that's important. And additionally, the entire business depends on keeping the river flowing. So working with the community and learning the community's own insights into what it takes to keep those rivers flowing, on which the company's own supply chain depends, has become at the heart of many companies' own operations and their future strategy.
Okay. It's greatly helped, though, where local people have got firm, recognised rights over that water and that landscape, because then government and companies are obliged to work with them and see where their interests are aligned. I think the difficulties come where you've got people who do not have formally recognised rights and where their particular rights to land and water can be ridden roughshod.
Okay. I do need to move on, sorry Herbert, but I just want to, because we've talked a lot about food for water, food for energy. I want to look about a bit about water for energy. So, Herbert, I mean, you know, I gave that figure at the beginning about half of all water withdrawals to sort of cool down thermoelectric sort of power stations. I mean, what are some of the, you know, given that power needs are increasing, water actually is becoming more used for power generation. How do we start to deal with that, given that there's increasing demands for more and more energy?
I mean, you point to something that is becoming even more dramatic in the future. Right now, there are rough estimates that on a per capita basis, 200 liters per capita of world population is used for cooling. Within the next 20 years, with some cross-section, a very rough analysis, this will go up to a 600 liters per capita per day, per capita of world population. So you have to find sources for that water. And here you have to understand that looking at, again, piecemeal will not work. You have to look at watershed, river basin individually. Each river basin is a different situation. Each watershed has to be looked at differently. And then you have to find ways to mobilize that water for the energy. I'm coming back to the Swiss experience. We would never have gotten out of poverty without energy. Mm-hmm. And there are other countries in the same situation. And there is a possibility. Agriculture today, when you look at the physiological need of plants and what you actually withdraw in water, it's something like 40% is what is withdrawn is the physiological need. So okay. With better efficiency, with a better allocation of water, you can mobilize that water that you may require for the cooling.
But I have to mean, Camilla, what's energy companies, what should they be doing? Because energy companies tend to be massive, they're sort of very powerful. What's the role of energy companies in dealing with this water issue?
Well, I think one of the things that they could well be doing is sourcing much more of their energy supply from small-scale producers. Yeah. There's been a tendency for big energy companies to think that that's kind of too complex. They've got a system that works for them. Why should they be bothered in sourcing from a large number of smaller producers? The transaction costs are too high. But actually, if we're really keen to get a diverse and resilient pattern of energy production, we should be trying to spread that production across a much larger number of smaller outlets.
David?
Yeah, this is really important for the balance of our energy mix. It's the hidden story that's headlined in the World Energy Outlook report at the end of last year. Of course, we all know that energy demand's increasing, but the need for water, the consumption of water for producing energy, that's increasing at more than twice the rate of energy demand. This is potentially catastrophic. Now, the point for the balance of energy supplies is that means that the apparent simple solutions like tar sands or fracking to develop shale gas, which everyone's racing to grab shale gas, everyone's ignoring this water consideration there, that we cannot continue to intensify the water use for the production of our energy.
Okay, thank you. Herbert Oberle-Hansley, Camilla Toulmin, David Norman, thank you very much. My name is Joe Confino. Thanks for joining us and see you later.
This debate is available to watch in video form on The Guardian's sustainable business site, guardian.co.uk/sustainable-business. Next week, we'll be bringing you the third and final debate in the Nexus series, looking at the connection of water and energy from treatment to transportation. Remember, for breaking science news day and night, just go to guardian.co.uk/science. This podcast was produced by me, Jason Phipps. Till next week, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.